This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the past 10 years, state funding for public 2- and 4-year colleges has been cut by more than $6 billion. And that's after adjusting for inflation. And in a handful of states like Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi, per-student funding has fallen by more than 30%. At the same time, federal funding for higher ed has also fallen. Back in 1979, Pell Grants, which are federal dollars given to low-income students to help pay for college, those Pell Grants went from covering 80% of the cost of attending a 4-year public institution to just 30%. Meanwhile, college costs have gone up more than 2,000%. Since 1970, for in-state tuition at public nonprofit schools and at private schools, a 2,000% increase in the cost since 1970. Compare that to how the buying power of a dollar has changed over the same time. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, consumer price index inflation has risen about 780% since 1970. So compare that 780% for the consumer price index to that 2,000% increase in college tuition. One is 60% less than the other. Well, now the Biden administration is trying to make higher ed more affordable by fixing the federal public loan forgiveness program, canceling a portion of student debt to offering more Pell Grants. Here's U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona.
College affordability is like a runaway train, and we're trying to put the brakes on that. We're putting in systems to stop the bleeding.
But is it really the federal government's job to control the cost of college? We want to know why colleges and universities aren't doing more themselves to make getting a degree less expensive. And joining us now is Eric Kelderman. He's a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be with you.
Okay, so first of all, let's talk a little bit about the proposals that are in Congress right now, specifically an act called the Skin in the Game Act. What does that propose to do?
Well, I guess in theory, it's supposed to make colleges, responsible for the debt of their students if they graduate or don't graduate and don't pay off that debt and require them to pay a portion of that back, broadly speaking. It's hard to see how that goes anywhere at this point.
Because of the fact that Congress might change, or it's not got a lot of fans as it is. Why?
Well, it's got one sponsor, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who is, he's very outspoken, but he's not necessarily influential in the Senate. We have, of course, a very closely divided chamber. So politically speaking, it's hard for really any legislation to go anywhere at this point. The Higher Education Act, which governs most of federal higher ed policy, expired in 2013, and we still haven't renewed that. So there are probably bigger proposals that Congress should take up before the Skin in the Game Act.
Yeah,
and there is a federal policy that deals with this sort of, broadly speaking, although not necessarily effectively. It's called the cohort default rate.
Meaning what?
So this is a regulation on the Department of Ed that says that if 40% of your students in any given year default on their loans, or if 30% of your students default on their loans over a period of 3 consecutive years, that you could lose access to federal title aid, federal student aid. That's typically a sort of death sentence for college. If they can't get Pell Grants and student loans, many of them close. The problem is that the bar is very high. Most colleges have default rates that are well below that.
Uh-huh.
And typically, many of them also pay companies to help them collect on those debts. So it's not entirely effective. Also, the sort of on-off switch of federal aid is not a very nuanced punishment. So, it doesn't really end up affecting very many colleges.
I see. Well, just going back to that Skin in the Game Act for just a moment here, mm-hmm. also just to point out the obvious, I imagine that many, if not most, legislators on Capitol Hill have some kind of institution of higher education in their district. So I imagine the lobby is pretty powerful, because I understand that that Skin in a Game, in the Game Act has had trouble even getting out of committee.
Right. Well, I'm sure that, yes, many, if not most colleges are probably opposed to this. There's also, you know, it's sort of an odd thing, right? Because the colleges themselves aren't taking out the loans.
Yeah.
It's the students. We don't really have that sort of accountability for any other industry in America, right? If you go take out a car loan, right, the bank is issuing the loan and they're on the hook. They have the risk. But it's the individual who's, you know, accountable for that debt. And if they don't pay that debt, then you lose your car. Same thing with mortgages, right? So in this case, you know, we have this unusual circumstance where for the past decade or so, it's the federal government that's been issuing most of the loans. There's a direct student loan program. We no longer work through the banks to do that. And we give the money to the students, right? Or sometimes their parents co-sign, et cetera. But it's not the institutions that are actually borrowing the money. So it's an unusual situation from sort of a logistical and legal standpoint.
Yeah. So this brings into question how the federal government influences your other major parts of the U.S. economy, right? Because you're right about the federal government issuing the loans to students for higher mm-hmm. ed. So we talked to Kevin Carey, who's vice president of education policy at the think tank New America, and he talked about how the federal system of student loans is quite unusual compared to how the federal government subsidizes other parts of the economy, as I mentioned, like healthcare.
So when the federal government subsidizes healthcare through Medicare or Medicaid, a big part of that is controlling the prices of healthcare, right? So if you are going to be a Medicaid provider, a Medicare provider, there are caps on how much money you can charge for certain kinds of services. For a long time, the big loophole in that was that there were no caps on prescription drugs, but we just fixed that, right? And that was something that there was a lot of consensus among thinkers that, no, it doesn't really make sense to have a big, you know, government program through Medicaid where the government has no ability to negotiate or control what drug companies can charge. And we ended up in this situation where U.S. federal government was paying 10 times as much for certain drugs as any other government in the world, way more than, you know, health insurance companies would pay. It just didn't make sense. But that's actually the way our higher education system works.
So, Eric, this sounds like a fantastical idea, but wouldn't it be amazing if the federal government could exercise some kind of negotiating power over the cost of tuition in higher ed?
That's an interesting idea. I don't necessarily have an opinion on it. Obviously, there's a lot of complexity that goes into that. And, you know, we should point out here that Medicaid is not a cost that's borne entirely by the federal government.
Yes.
The states, it's a cost-sharing program. And, in fact, the largest portion of most state budgets is, in fact, their Medicaid spending. And so and that ties up state lawmakers' hands. You know, if that's the largest part of your budget, then that eats up a lot of other things, right? So it's not just the institutions that might object to that idea. If you had to force the states to come in and provide a certain level of funding, which a lot of people are in favor of, by the way, you know, that would get a lot of pushback from conservative-leaning states and maybe some other states as well, who already provide a significant amount of subsidy to their institutions.
Let's talk about another plan that's being bandied about on Capitol Hill, because recently Republican Representative Virginia Fox of North Carolina filed a bill called the Responsible Education Assistance Through Loan Reforms Act. And that bill would cap currently unlimited loans to graduate students. It's estimated that about a half of student loan debt comes from people pursuing graduate degrees. So here's Representative Fox back in September.
How can an institution justify charging $100,000 for a master's in social work when a quick Google search shows that social work salaries are not likely to earn six figures? It's not surprising that research shows 40% of master's programs have a negative return on investment. The cost of non-repayment can no longer fall squarely on taxpayers. Schools must be on the hook for a share of the taxpayer losses proportionate to the riskiness of the programs they encourage prospective students to enroll in.
So, Eric, I should note that Democrats are opposed to the caps of the type proposed by Representative Fox. But your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, it's an interesting proposal. It's not just grad loans that are the grad plus loans that are unlimited. There's also Parent Plus. And that has put a significant burden on, for instance, parents of with students of color who take out extraordinary amounts of debt to try and get their student through college. So that's a burden for them as well. Certainly, this is an area where I think a lot of colleges do have some room to sort of some introspection about their program offerings and the pricing. There was a great series of articles by the Wall Street Journal not long ago that showed about the $100,000 social work program at USC. There's also talk about, for instance, the price of the journalism master's program at Columbia, which is also very, very expensive. And so I think, you know, that's an interesting idea. We don't grad programs are more expensive to deliver, in part because smaller class sizes, for instance, things like that. And also you're typically providing those people with a stipend to do a teaching assistantship and things like that. But certainly colleges have some room to think about, offering programs that are truly going to have some return on investment for students and not put them in a precarious place financially.
Okay, so when we come back from the break, we're going to be speaking to a former governor and current college president about how his university has actually accomplished this. They've taken specific steps over the past 10 years to put the brakes, literally, on the rate of increase in college tuition. And we'll find out how they did it when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the role colleges and universities themselves could play in helping control the high cost of higher education. And I'm joined today by Eric Kelderman. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And now let's turn to Mitch Daniels. He's the former governor of the state of Indiana. He served in that position from 2005 to 2013. And thereafter, from 2013 onward, he became president of Purdue University, which has done some pretty interesting things in controlling tuition costs for its students. Governor Daniels, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
So I know you've talked a lot about this because many people are holding Purdue up as an example of the things that can be done. So let's dig into some of the numbers, Governor, if we could, because I was acquainting myself with Purdue's financial reports over the past 10 years. And I see that in 2012, revenue from tuition for Purdue was about 36% of revenues. So I'm looking at some $708 million. By 2022, revenues from tuitions held at about 35% of revenues, although, of course, with inflation costs increased to $1.46 billion. So how'd you do that? How'd you hold that steady?
We made it our top priority. Our priority is not as value, which is to say quality over price, but we've asked ourselves each year that what would we need to do to avoid a tuition increase on our students and families. I sometimes say we solved the equation for zero, and I do believe we've achieved a nearly universal enthusiasm on our campus for doing this, which means that everybody thinks about it and looks for ways, small as well as large, to restrain costs. It's also fair to say that once this cycle started, and by cycle I mean we're now a decade into us not just holding tuition where it was, but we've lowered the cost of room and board and books. The all-in cost, so-called cost of attendance at Purdue, is lower in unadjusted nominal dollars now than it was in 2012. Our room and board costs have gone from most expensive to least expensive in our peer group. So this can only happen when you have alignment around a goal that across a universe, across a an institution in the size of ours.
Mm-hmm.
The virtuous cycle, as some people call it, has been that our student body has grown by 30%, so our revenues have grown without a price increase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we know that from surveying our students that there are multiple factors, starting with academic quality, but a reputation for care about affordability has been a major contributor to that growth.
Yeah. So let me put some details on what you're saying, Governor Daniels. That first of all, Purdue is now, what, in the 11th year of this tuition freeze, essentially. So if you're a student from the state of Indiana, you're paying for tuition $9,992 per year. If you're out of state or international, it's at the undergraduate level, I believe it's $28,794. And that's been the same for the past 10 years. Now, we're going to come back to the growth in the student body numbers in just a second, Governor. But that first couple of years where you instituted the tuition freeze, it also meant some belt tightening at Purdue, right? I was reading that it meant some you had to forfeit some $40 million in the first 2 years of what would normally have been a regular price increase. And that meant making some cuts in certain places. What were those cuts?
Megan, I'd love to tell you that it was all very difficult, but that really wouldn't be so. It was the fruit hangs pretty low in higher ed. After decades, as you illustrated in the previous segment, of increases, essentially unfettered increases. They raised prices because they could, because the general rules that govern competitive markets weren't operating here. So there was, as I say, a lot of there was some fairly easy adjustments to make. I want to say that we never would use a word like forfeit to describe our declining to impose an increase on our students. We view it very much the other way around, that the presumption ought to be that we will not do that unless we absolutely have to. Over the last decade, Purdue families are in possession of $1.3 billion that they would have paid to us if we had raised costs at the national average.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay, forfeit me. I take your point about that. But I do want to, I'm just kind of looking at the numbers here. And if we're using Purdue as an example, which I think we should, I want to understand in as much detail as possible how that happened. So, because there was a $40 million cut, for lack of a better term, in those first couple of years. And I'm seeing that that Purdue had to make decisions sort of across the board on where to find those dollars, right? Everything from selling off some automobiles to foregoing merit increases, right, for some personnel.
No, absolutely not on the other. We have raised salaries here at or above the peer average every single year. We've been at the top in many years, including this one. No, I'll give you some examples. I know that people are curious. We modernized our health care plan, which was very old-fashioned, now is more consumer-driven. That's contributed significantly. We're very careful about capital projects. There was a lot of gold plating. There was a lot of waste, over-specification of both new projects and renovation projects. So we We scrutinize that pretty carefully. Space utilization is another example. Lots and lots of space going unused nobody noticed. And we were able to repurpose some of that and thereby exercise some cost avoidance. So a few big steps, but very honestly, a lot of small ones. We talk at Purdue in addition to full-time equivalents or FTEs, SDEs, student tuition equivalents, and encourage people that, yes, maybe $10,000 doesn't sound like much, but that's a whole year for one of our students.
Yeah. Just to clarify, when I was talking about merit increases, what I had understood from reporting back in 2013 was that it was at least a temporary foregoing of merit increases for personnel at high administrative level, so not necessarily faculty or instruction.
Yes, that's correct. And it only affected a few people, but we thought it was an important statement to make. This is a whole other category. The bloat of administration in higher ed has been chronicled. Eric and others have written a lot about this, and we scrutinize that very carefully. We watch among the ratios and measures that we watch with the most care are students to administrators and faculty to administrators, and we've brought those down a lot. Now, the federal government, you're going to ask at some point what they could do, and one thing they could certainly do is deregulate and relax some of the, useless impositions that they have placed on schools. It's not a complete excuse for the administrative excesses, but it's part of it.
Yeah. So the freeze on tuition, you mentioned this before, and I want to dig into it a little bit more, Governor Daniels. It actually led to big increase in the number of students applying to Purdue and then the size of the student body overall, right? I was thinking of seeing that as the freeze entered its second year. So we're talking, 2014 or so? Number of undergraduate applicants to Purdue jumped by almost 30%.
That's correct. We won't know about this year for a little bit longer, but it's pretty clear that, again, it'll be another record. Applications are up 200%+, more than doubled. Over this time period. And again, I think multiple factors are at play. But, Meghna, we're a land-grant school, and we're very, very imbued with that ethic, which was to widen the doors of higher education. And we always talk about the fact here that we want to be known not by how many young people we turn away, but by how many we turn out. And so growing as we have from 28 or 29,000 to 38,000 undergrads, there's also a big expansion of the graduate population. Yes, it has certainly contributed to our ability to restrain costs, but primarily it's an implementation of our central mission, and we're very delighted that we're pursuing it in this way.
You know, Governor Daniels, I'm trying to understand how this might be scalable to other colleges and universities across the country. Because help me be sure that I've kind of got the big picture at Purdue correct, because you've definitely frozen tuition for students. But has the cost of running the university also slowed down, or have you just been able to find other places to raise the revenue, such as alumni dollars or other forms of fundraising?
No, it's at the operating level, it's been a matter of increased revenue due entirely to a growth in population, student population, and what we believe is only appropriate and natural care with expenses. You ask about other schools. We never have prescribed or preached what we're doing for anybody else, but I'll just observe that I guess it's only human, but where there has not been the restraint of genuine market competition, when there's been no measurement of quality, here was a central problem I've always thought that I sometimes say if we set out to design a system that would cost too much, it would look pretty much like today's higher ed. You're selling what has been deemed a necessity. That assumption is now being challenged. Does everybody really need a four-year degree? You've had total pricing power because people couldn't tell whether a degree from school A was better or not than a degree from school B. They sometimes accepted that if it costs more, it must be better when there was no evidence of that. You flood that marketplace with third-party subsidies like the government has, which immunize the customer, at least temporarily, against the cost of what they're running up. And then just to make sure it costs too much, you have the federal government regulate everything it can think of and impose the costs that come with that. So we shouldn't be surprised we're where we are. Mm-hmm. I'm only surprised it's taken so long for the marketplace and also finally public authorities to respond.
Yeah. Well, Governor Daniels, if I may, you said that you've never claimed that Purdue should be an example for other colleges and universities. I'm wondering why not?
I'm only saying that we have held ourselves out as in a position to advise others what they should do. We have been pursuing the land-grant mission as we understand and see it, and doing what we think is only a right in terms of the interest of our primary customer, which is the student and her or his family.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask the question then to Eric. I'll turn back to you, Eric Kelderman, at the Chronicle of Higher Education. How replicable do you think Purdue's system of freezing tuition and finding cost controls and other ways in other places and other means of growth, how replicable is that in other colleges and universities?
Well, first I want to say hi to Mr. Daniels. I've had a chance to talk to him frequently, and it's always a pleasure to be on the air with him. But, I think within that sector of higher education, which is large, relatively prestigious land-grant universities, I think a lot of institutions are doing something similar. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the University of California system, something like half of their graduates incur no debt. I think Purdue, it's maybe higher than that, which is admirable. And Ohio State, for instance, the president there has just begun a pilot program with the plan to make all students graduate without student loans. Part of that's, on the prowess of fundraising, et cetera. So I think within that sector, certainly there's the ability to do much of what Purdue has done, and many institutions are pursuing a similar path.
Mm. Well, Governor Daniels, a little earlier we talked about the notion that that's being considered, although not very seriously, on Capitol Hill, that there have to be some ways to put colleges on the hook for loans that students can't pay back for various reasons. And I wonder what you think about that, because I believe in your recent op-ed that you wrote in the Wall Street Journal, you said colleges should always have been at some risk for any non-repayments by graduates. And tell me more about that.
I absolutely think so, and I think it would be very effective even at a modest sharing of that risk. I didn't agree with the comments made a little earlier that try to distinguish this from other markets. I believe if someone confers a diploma that turns out not to have really taught the through an education that turns out not to have taught the young person much or much of useful value, that's a breach of warranty. And automakers, I think, was an example given, can be on the hook for some of the shortcomings of a product that they produced and charged for. So I believe it'd be very effective, by the way. Even a small amount of money would get the attention of colleges and universities, plus the embarrassment factor of an annual report that says that a given school had to return a certain amount to the lender would, I think, have lead to some behavior modification. So I've always thought it was a good idea. Here at Purdue, we have offered an alternative to the very expensive Parent Plus and private loans, where we stand behind the education we're providing. These are so-called income share agreements, and If the student doesn't pay it back, the risk is shifted entirely to us and our co-investors. We are willing to do that, and it's Purdue students and graduates being what they are, 99%+ pay back their student loans. That's working very well.
Just, you know, I want to get sort of a simple reality check on the system as we have it right now. I mean, as a college, as university president, Governor Daniels, just what stops any university right now from increasing tuition costs year after year?
I think finally there is back pressure in the marketplace. There is some skepticism about the absolute necessity or appropriateness of the four-year degree or residential degree. There are new alternative certifications. Many in business have found that the diplomas they were using as a proxy for talent in hiring really weren't telling them very much. Now they're starting to look for other ways of determining that a given young woman or man is a good hire. So it took longer than I thought, but I think you're starting to see some diminution of this and, past time for that.
Governor Daniels, hold on for just a second. Got a couple more questions for you when we come back. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed, 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're exploring what colleges and universities themselves can do to help get a handle on the continually surging cost of higher ed. I'm joined today by Eric Kelderman. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And Mitch Daniels is with us as well, former governor of the state of Indiana. He's the Republican governor of Indiana from 2005 to 2013. And thereafter, he's been serving as the president of Purdue University, which has managed to freeze tuition for its students for the past 10 years. And we've been exploring how Purdue has done that. Now, there's one thing I actually just want to circle back quickly to, because we went over it very rapidly, but it's something that listeners keep bringing up with us again and again, and it's that administrative bloat problem. Because we received this call from Gene, who's in Los Angeles, and he's a professor at a Los Angeles area university, and he's been in higher ed for something like 20 years now. And here are the changes that he's noticed.
I have noticed that the expenses of the university have gone drastically. What I can tell you for sure is that all this additional money is not going to the faculty, not going to the professor, the teachers working at a school. What is happening can be summarized by two words: administrative bloat. Seems every other day I see in my email something about the hiring of some new administrator managing some program or furthering some cause that didn't exist 10, 15 years ago.
That's Gene, who listens to On Point from Los Angeles. Now, of course, it varies from university to university, but let's pick one of the Ivies. Yale, for example, has 5,066 managers and staff compared to 4,937 instructors at the university. Eric, can you tell us more about how much so-called administrative bloat plays in the cost issue?
Well, I'll give you a couple of thoughts on this. One is, I think if you talk to people who study higher education finance, they would say that really administrative bloat is something of a red herring. Mm. Certainly, the things that colleges do now are far more expansive than they did, say, a quarter century or ago or more, right? But many of these things are things that I think families and students want, right, and also that help support students in their success. For instance, more academic advisors, right? Career counseling centers, tutoring, student affairs people who work with students in the dorm or for mental health issues. Some of this, you know, in quote, administrators, ends up being staff who are there to aid students more directly. Some of it is, as Mr. Daniels points out, federal regulatory burden, mm-hmm, for things like, for instance, Title IX. Mm-hmm. Many students before, or many institutions before, say, 2008, didn't have a dedicated Title IX coordinator. That's the federal law that requires gender equity in higher education and also is used to prevent sexual harassment, sexual misconduct, or punish those behaviors. And so, but there's also very complex rules around, say, federal grant compliance, super complex stuff. Big research universities like Purdue have hazardous chemicals that they have to truck in and out of their campus for research, for valuable research that I'm sure most people support. Those are all big expenses, it's true. But if you're a large research university, many of those things are necessary to your continued success. At a small private liberal arts college where you're not doing you don't have a biohazard certified lab, those costs are very different.
Mm. So there's a reason for a lot of the so-called bloat, is what you're saying.
I mean, yeah. Some of it certainly. Yeah. Certainly, we could argue about what's necessary and what isn't. But I would say that, we expect more of colleges today than we did 25 years ago, mm-hmm, right? We want students to succeed now. That wasn't always the case. That used to be the case where, the old saw about the opening convocation and the president would say, look to your left, look to your right, and in 4 years, two of you won't be here. We've decided that those metrics for success are not any more acceptable, right? It's a necessity now, or at least that's the message, that you have some sort of post-secondary education. And so to the extent that we're supporting students, that administrative bloat is student support or things that make the student experience better, then I think people generally want those kinds of supports. And I should point out, that places like Purdue, want those students to succeed and mm-hmm have those supports in place for students. So mm-hmm. We could blame administrative bloat, but I don't think that's really necessarily the primary driver of college price, certainly.
Yeah. Well, actually, then, what do you think the primary driver is?
Well, if you're a very selective institution, you've got the market forces in your favor. You can charge a lot, and people are going to pay a lot to go there. Yeah. If you're a Yale or a Harvard, then you can raise your tuition really without much consequence, at least within some limit, right? If you're a community college or a public regional institution, Southwest Missouri State, University of Northern Iowa, right, the market doesn't support those kinds of tuition increases. Iowans wouldn't stand for that. Missourians wouldn't stand for, in-state tuition of $30,000 or $40,000 at a public regional institution. So it's the cost of running the institution. Faculty are highly trained professionals, right? They have graduate degrees. There's more competition for those kinds of administrators or for those kinds of employees. And the people that work on colleges, campuses generally, have those kind of degrees and are expecting to be paid more and often are. So there's that. There is, as you point out, the shrinking of state support as not so much budget cuts per se, but as enrollment rose, through the 90s and the early 2000s pretty steadily, state support just couldn't keep up with the enrollment increases. And so we've seen declines in per student funding from the states.
You sort of mentioned something that is something I've heard for years now, that education, by definition, in order to give and receive a good education, it's not something that you can apply the normal— in the classroom, the normal rules of efficiency too, right? You need a certain you need a certain number of educators to teach those students in the universities. But Governor Daniels, as he pointed out earlier at Purdue, they've managed to maintain a very good and competitive faculty and staff to student ratio, and still at mm-hmm. the same time control those tuition costs. Now, Governor mm-hmm. Daniels, let me turn back to you here for a second, because there's, Eric had mentioned community colleges. And as you know, one of the things that the Biden administration has been proposing is a free community college plan. So we asked Kevin Carey, who we heard from earlier in the show, that education expert from the New America think tank, about why most colleges are actually opposed to the Biden administration's free community college plan.
President Biden's free community college plan was a form of price controls. You know, free is a price control. It's just setting all the prices to zero. Colleges don't want to be free. People should understand that when we talk about, why haven't we implemented the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren free college plan? It's not just because Republicans are opposed to it, although they are. Colleges are opposed to it. They don't want to be free. They don't want the government deciding how much money they charge, which means deciding how much money they get. They want to be in the business of selling something expensive and valuable to wealthy people. That's a good business to be in.
Mitch Daniels, your thoughts on that?
Well, that's an interesting angle. I mean, I think there are other reasons to be troubled about the proposal, starting with the fact that the nation doesn't have the money. We're borrowing all this money. You know, the notion, by the way, that student debt has been canceled is a complete misnomer. It hasn't been canceled. It's been transferred from people who borrowed the money to people who didn't. And so here on community colleges, I've struggled with this and wrestled with this in two lives now. A better, more effective community college system would be a great thing for this country. It's not performing very well in most places, with graduation rates in the teens. Mm-hmm. And until we find better ways to help young people or make sure young people succeed, much as Eric correctly identified the new efforts that are going on in conventional higher ed, until we do that, I think you also want to just be careful about even further subsidies of that system.
Yeah. Well, Mitch Daniels, president of Purdue University and former governor of the state of Indiana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Appreciate being included.
All right. Well, Eric, let's listen to some other examples here of things that colleges and universities have done to try to get a handle on costs here. We spoke with Michael Sorrell. He's president of Paul Quinn College. It's a small, historically Black private school in Dallas, Texas. And they made the decision to, instead of being in that sort of facilities arms race, which might be familiar on very many college campuses, they actually decided to tear some buildings down. They even cut the football team, which is kind of unimaginable in the state of Texas, but they did it.
Full disclosure, I will either go down in history as a genius or a madman. There will be no in between, because when you kick out that many students, effectively what you are saying is, we're going to take the hit on our graduation rate. We're going to take a hit on our retention rate, and these are all short term. We're going to be criticized because it's completely against conventional thought. So it was highly unconventional. I pull no punches about that, but it's also been highly effective.
And Sorrell says it's been effective because they were able to save $600,000 per year. I mean, Eric, I was half joking but half serious that it's quite a thing in Texas to say, I'm going to cut the football program. The deeper issue is these are innovative places to look for cost controls. Why do you think other schools ought to do that more?
Well, I think we need a little context around the Paul Quinn example. And I know Mr. Sorrell well, and he has been very successful in maintaining a school that was quite literally on the verge of financial failure. So when they cut the football team, and by the way, turned the football field into an organic farm, which I thought was brilliant, they had maybe at that time, maybe 30 days operating cash. Mm-hmm. They were on the verge of losing their accreditation, which would have shut them down probably. The buildings were an added cost. And so this wasn't an affordability measure, let's be clear.
It was a survival measure.
It was survival at the point. And what I think is more innovative in some ways about the Paul Quinn model is Mr. Sorrell has created what's a work college. So every student on that campus now has a job at the college, which is great. It gives them some connection to the institution. It provides them some either income or some financial aid help. And it helps maintain the costs of the institution. So I think that's great. The overall question of athletics is difficult. And again, I want to say that it goes back to the sector of higher education we're talking about. If you're a Big Ten school, right, where your football program is bringing in pretty much all the revenues that you need to run the athletics department, that's one thing. And with a small subsidy, a lot of smaller liberal arts colleges use athletics as a recruiting tool because students want to play sports after they graduate high school, but they maybe aren't good enough to play at a higher level of NCAA or NAIA competition. So that actually brings in tuition revenue for those institutions.
Mm. Well, so point taken on the specifics around Paul Quinn College, but let's swing over to the other end of the pendulum in terms of size.
Mm-hmm.
When thinking about, for example, a program at Ohio State University.
Right.
This is Christina Johnson, and this year she's the president of Ohio State, and she launched a pilot program offering 125 graduate students from undergraduate students from low and middle income families, a combination of grants, internships, and research work rather than them taking federal loans.
So this isn't free college, it's not free tuition. But it's a pathway towards debt-free. Because we know when students graduate without debt, their world is just so much more open and free to make the kind of choices that we want them to be able to make.
Eric, your thoughts and context on this program at Ohio State?
Ohio State certainly isn't the first to do this. A lot of wealthy, prestigious privates have done so, and Ohio State is one of the first large publics to do so. It's a great idea. If you're an institution that can raise the amount of money necessary to provide financial aid. So this isn't Ohio State saying we're going to cut our price, our tuition price. This is Ohio State saying we're going to provide enough aid for students through grants and through work opportunities that you can afford our institution. And so that's terrific for the students who can get into Ohio State.
Mm. So,
but it doesn't work, right? So if you're a small public regional that serves 5 or 10,000 students and you're drawing only folks from, say, the first 60 or 100 miles around your campus, and you don't have a big research program and you don't have a football program that's on TV every Saturday or Sunday during the football season, and drawing students from across, from internationally or across straight lines who are paying full tuition and subsidizing other students, it's far more difficult if you're a small private liberal arts college.
Well, so this is exactly similar. The point that I wanted for us to wrap up with, because, thinking back to what Mitch Daniels was saying about Purdue, he was very clear that part of the reason why they were able to have that tuition freeze is because they've increased the size of the student body dramatically also.
Right.
And so that's possible at a place like Purdue. That's a solution that works for Purdue. There was that other, cutting the football team at Paul Quinn that works for them. The point is that higher ed is very diverse, right, across this country in terms
absolutely.
Of size of institutions, programs offered, student bodies served. So there's not going to be one specific solution. But is the mere threat of more federal government involvement here enough that it's getting more places, institutions of higher ed, to think about how they themselves can control their costs better?
I do think federal involvement, if it comes to fruition, if we start talking about price control, certainly institutions are going to respond in some fashion to that. I think in the short term, and maybe even in the medium and long term, the more powerful driver is going to be the fact that the number of high school students across the country is declining. College enrollments are set to go down by 15 or so percent, or the number of high school graduates will decline by 15% starting after next year.
Well, Eric Kelderman, senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.